If anyone had known the care lavished on that dolly, I think it would have touched their hearts, even while they laughed. She brought it bits of bouquets. She read to it, took it out to breathe the air, hidden under her coat. She sang it lullabies and never went to bed without kissing its dirty face and whispering tenderly, "I hope you'll have a good night, my poor dear." Beth had her troubles as well as the others, and not being an angel but a very human little girl, she often wept a little weep, as Joe said, because she couldn't take music lessons and have a fine piano. She loved music so dearly, tried so hard to learn, and practiced away so patiently at the jingling old instrument, that it did seem as if someone, not to hint Aunt March, ought to help her. Nobody did, however, and nobody saw Beth wipe the tears off the yellow keys that wouldn't keep in tune when she was all alone. She sang like a little lark about her work, never was too tired to play for Marmy and the girls, and day after day said hopefully to herself, "I know I'll get my music sometime, if I'm good." There are many Beths in the world, shy and quiet, sitting in corners till needed, and living for others so cheerfully that no one sees the sacrifices till the little cricket on the hearth stops chirping, and the sweet, sunshiny presence vanishes, leaving silence and shadow behind. If anybody had asked Amy what the greatest trial of her life was, she would have answered at once, "My nose." When she was a baby, Jo had accidentally dropped her into the coal hod, and Amy insisted that the fall had ruined her nose forever. It was not big or red, like poor Petria's. It was only rather flat, and all the pinching in the world could not give it an aristocratic point. No one minded it but herself, and it was doing its best to grow, but Amy felt deeply the want of a Grecian nose, and drew whole sheets of handsome ones to console herself. Little Raphael, as her sisters called her, had a decided talent for drawing, and was never so happy as when copying flowers, designing fairies, or illustrating stories with queer specimens of art. Her teachers complained that instead of doing her sums, she covered her slate with animals. The blank pages of her atlas were used to copy maps on, and caricatures of the most ludicrous description came fluttering out of all her books at unlucky moments. She got through her lessons as well as she could, and managed to escape reprimands by being a model of deportment. She was a great favorite with her mates, being good-tempered and possessing the happy art of pleasing without effort. Her little airs and graces were much admired. So were her accomplishments, for beside her drawing she could play 12 tunes, crochet, and read French without mispronouncing more than 2/3 of the words. She had a plaintive way of saying, "When Papa was rich, we did so and so," which was very touching. And her long words were considered perfectly elegant by the girls. Amy was in a fair way to be spoiled, for everyone petted her, and her small vanities and selfishnesses were growing nicely. One thing, however, rather quenched the vanities. She had to wear her cousin's clothes. Now, Florence's mama hadn't a particle of taste, and Amy suffered deeply at having to wear a red instead of a blue bonnet, unbecoming gowns, and fussy aprons that did not fit. Everything was good, well made, and little worn, but Amy's artistic eyes were much afflicted, especially this winter, when her school dress was a dull purple with yellow dots and no trimming. "My only comfort," she said to Meg, with tears in her eyes, "is that Mother doesn't take tucks in my dresses whenever I'm naughty, as Maria Parks's mother does. My dear, it's really dreadful, for sometimes she is so bad her frock is up to her knees, and she can't come to school. When I think of this degradation, I feel that I can bear even my flat nose and purple gown with yellow skyrockets on it." Meg was Amy's confidant and monitor, and by some strange attraction of opposites, Jo was gentle Beth's. To Jo alone did the shy child tell her thoughts, and over her big, harum-scarum sister, Beth unconsciously exercised more influence than anyone in the family. The two older girls were a great deal to one another, but each took one of the younger into her keeping and watched over her in her own way. Playing mother, they called it, and put their sisters in the places of discarded dolls. with the maternal instinct of little women. "Has anybody got anything to tell? It's been such a dismal day, I'm really dying for some amusement," said Meg, as they sat sewing together that evening. "I had a queer time with Aunt today, and as I got the best of it, I'll tell you about it," began Joe, who dearly loved to tell stories. "I was reading that everlasting Belsham, and droning away, as I always do, for Aunt soon drops off, and then I take out some nice book, and read like fury till she wakes up. I actually made myself sleepy, and before she began to nod, I gave such a gape that she asked me what I meant by opening my mouth wide enough to take the whole book in at once. I wish I could and be done with it," said I, trying not to be saucy. Then she gave me a long lecture on my sins and told me to sit and think them over while she just lost herself for a moment. She never finds herself very soon, so the minute her cap began to bob like a top-heavy dahlia, I whipped the Vicar of Wakefield out of my pocket and ran away with one eye on him and one on Aunt. I just got to where they all tumbled into the water when I forgot and laughed out loud. Aunt woke up and, being more good-natured after her nap, told me to read a bit and show what frivolous work I preferred to the worthy and instructive Belsham. I did my very best, and she liked it, though she only said, "I don't understand what it's all about. Go back and begin it, child." Back I went, and made the primroses as interesting as ever I could. Once I was wicked enough to stop in a thrilling place and say meekly, "I'm afraid it tires you, ma'am. Shan't I stop now?" She caught up her knitting, which had dropped out of her hands, and gave me a sharp look through her specs, and said, in her short way, "Finish the chapter, and don't be impertinent, miss."
"Did she own she liked it?" asked Meg.
"Oh, bless you, no! But she let old Belsham rest, and when I ran back after my gloves this afternoon, there she was, so hard at the vicar that she didn't hear me laugh as I danced a jig in the hall because of the good time coming. What a pleasant life she might have, if she only chose! I don't envy her much, in spite of her money, for after all, rich people have about as many worries as poor ones, I think," added Joe. "That reminds me," said Meg, "that I've got something to tell. It isn't funny, like Joe's story, but I thought about it a good deal as I came home. At the King's today, I found everybody in a flurry, and one of the children said that her oldest brother had done something dreadful, and Papa had sent him away. I heard Mrs. King crying and Mr. King talking very loud, and Grace and Ellen turned away their faces when they passed me, so I shouldn't see how red their eyes were. I didn't ask any questions, of course, but I felt so sorry for them, and was rather glad I hadn't any wild brothers to do wicked things and disgrace the family. I think being disgraced in school is a great deal tryinger than anything bad boys can do," said Amy, shaking her head as if her experience of life had been a deep one. "Susie Perkins came to school today with a lovely red carnelian ring. I wanted it dreadfully, and wished I was her with all my might. Well, she drew a picture of Mr. Davis with a monstrous nose and a hump, and the words, 'Young ladies, my eye is upon you,' coming out of his mouth in a balloon thing. We were laughing over it when all of a sudden his eye was on us, and he ordered Susie to bring up her slate. She was paralyzed with fright, but she went, and oh, what do you think he did? He took her by the ear, just fancy how horrid, and led her to the recitation platform and made her stand there half an hour, holding that slate so everyone could see."
"Didn't the girls laugh at the picture?" asked Joe, who relished the scrape.
"Laugh? Not one. They sat as still as mice, and Susie cried quarts, I know she did. I didn't envy her then, for I felt that millions of carnelian rings wouldn't have made me happy after that. I never, never should have got over such an agonizing mortification." And Amy went on with her work, in the proud consciousness of virtue and the successful utterance of two long words in a breath. "I saw something that I liked this morning, and I meant to tell it at dinner, but I forgot," said Beth, putting Joe's topsy-turvy basket in order as she talked. "When I went to get some oysters for Hannah, Mr. Lawrence was in the fish shop. But he didn't see me, for I kept behind a barrel, and he was busy with Mr. Cutter, the fishman. A poor woman came in with a pail and a mop, and asked Mr. Cutter if he would let her do some scrubbing for a bit of fish, because she hadn't any dinner for her children, and had been disappointed of a day's work. Mr. Cutter was in a hurry, and said no, rather crossly. So she was going away,
looking hungry and sorry, when Mr. Lawrence hooked up a big fish with the crooked end of his cane and held it out to her.